Prabhupada ki jai. Shri Sadh Goswami Prabhu ki jai. Nitai Gaur Premanandi. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Shrimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Tanam. Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharani Nivisesha Sunyavadi Pastachare Shata. Hare Krishna. Hare
Krishna.
So? Everything is okay?
Yes.
The what's
there? Computer is okay?
Well, I guess so. I don't know.
I have to switch the volume down because
the feedback?
The feedback issues.
Okay. Okay, well, let's have a look. Will we know if somebody is calling us?
We won't know.
Then better to take the screen out and then you can see.
Yeah, maybe it'll be easier for me to keep
that way you can keep your eye on it. Hare Krishna! Hare Bol Prabhu! Welcome! Gauranga. Prabhu, it's very good that you could come and join us. Thank you very much. What is your name again, Prabhu?
Rohit.
Rohit. Okay, that's very good. Rohit on the Senate?
Mystery.
Mukesh's
brother.
Yes, that's it. Yes, yes. I know, but I just couldn't remember your first name. I get confused by names. So anyway, this is very... And you know Ashok and Jayananda Prabhus. Yes. Good. Hare Krishna. So, we're going to read from Nectar of Devotion, and we have a few copies. So we're actually on the last but one chapter. But the good news is that after we finish Nectar of Devotion, we're going to start again from the beginning, because it is such an important book, and it helps us really understand very carefully what the science of devotional service actually is. It takes all the guesswork out of it. It makes it very clear and scientific. So we've been reading from chapter 50, which is the further analysis of mixed rasas. And my understanding is that we didn't read the last two paragraphs on page 395.
That's right.
So this we can start reading today. But just to... Just to get the idea, if we look at the beginning of the chapter, we see that Prabhupada explains the principle of compatible and incompatibility. He's saying, just at the beginning of this chapter, which is further analysis of mixed rasas, because we're looking at mixed relationships. Sorry?
Have you read the translation?
Oh, no, we haven't. Yeah. That's a really good idea. Would you like to read it? Either one of you. As you wish.
I offer my respectful obeisances unto the six Goswamis, namely, Shri Sanatan Goswami, Shri Rupa Goswami, Shri Raghunath Bhatta Goswami, Shri Raghunath Dasa Goswami, Shri Jiva Goswami, and Shri Gopal Bhatta Goswami. Were very expert in scrutinizing and studying all the revealed scriptures with the aim of establishing eternal religious principles for the benefit of all human beings. Thus they are honored all over the three worlds, and they are worth taking shelter of, because they are absorbed in the mood of the gopis and are engaged in the transcendental loving service of Radha and Krishna.
Haribol. Good, thank you, Prabhupada. So this... is a further analysis of mixed rasas. So rasas are mixed, and the principles given at the beginning of the chapter, as already described, if certain kinds of mellows become mixed and there is a joining of opposite mellows, then the situation is called incompatible. When one is eating sweet rice and something salty or sour is mixed in, the mixture is not very tasteful and it's called incompatible. So the idea is that sometimes there are mixtures of rasas. As you may be aware, that there are five primary rasas in devotional service, which are? What are the five primary rasas?
Neutral relationship.
So then neutral love of God, yes?
Yeah, then it's servitorship, okay. Then friendship,
yes.
Parental love,
yeah.
And conjugal love.
Conjugal love. So these five primary rasas exist, which are very positive, loving dealings with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And there are seven indirect or secondary rasas, which are, can you recall what are the indirect rasas?
In laughing.
Yes, hasya rasa. Yeah.
Astonishment.
Chivalry.
Ghastliness.
Anger.
Ghastliness. And then dread.
Dread. And
compassion.
Yes, that's it. Seven. Yes. Okay. So these are different flavors of devotional service which are rendered to Krishna. So, for example, can anyone think of an example of someone experiencing dread in their relationship with Krishna?
When Krishna was fighting Kaliya, you know, and he was. He was surrounded by Kali from all sides, you know, and Kali was holding him on his chest all the time, you know, at that time, you know, all these coward boys, everybody else, those who saw him, you know. They were surrounded, particularly his mother as well, you know.
Yes. They were experiencing dread in their loving dealings with Krishna. They're thinking, what happens, if something happens to Krishna, this is terrible news. Because they're thinking, if something happens to Krishna, we're finished, our life is over. So they have so much love for Krishna. And sometimes chivalry, can we get some example of chivalrous dealings with Krishna? You can cheat, you can look in the book. Have a look. Okay, there's a chapter called Astonishment and Chivalry. Okay, chivalry, if we look on page 366, very nice, if you read perhaps the second paragraph in there. Ashok, would you like to read that one for us, please, on 367?
Right, Ashok?
Yeah.
Are you all right?
Yeah.
Okay.
When a friend?
367, please. Yeah. 367, please. Yeah, first paragraph.
Okay. When a friend wants to satisfy Krishna by performing some chivalrous activities, the friend becomes the challenger, and Krishna himself becomes opponent. Or else Krishna may give audience to the fighting, and by his desire, another friend becomes the opponent. A friend once challenged Krishna thus, My dear Madhava, you are very restless because you think that no one can defeat you. But if you do not flee from here, then I shall show you how I can defeat you, and my friends will be very satisfied to see this.
So this is a nice example of chivalrous dealings with Krishna, challenging and sporting on a level of equality, actually. So this is a very interesting platform. And generally we know of the five primary rasas. So how would we describe the five primary rasas? How would we describe, for example, what is called shantarasa, or neutral love of God? Some symptoms. Give us some ideas. What do we know about shantarasa?
You do some love for Krishna, but it's not in very enthusiastic way. You know, it's just passive adoration.
Yes, it's not much active. Yes, yes. And anything else we can say? Nowadays, we talk about when you go into computing, you get an entry level computer. Yes, sometimes. So the idea is that shantarasa is the entry level of devotional service, where one's devotional service practically begins in that actual neutral mood of passive adoration of Krishna. That's the beginning of devotional service. But then it progresses from there to an actual development of servitorship, which is called... Which rasa is that? That's called... Dasya rasa.
Dasya rasa.
Yeah. Just like we're all, when we're initiated, the clue is that we're all such and such das, or such and such dasi. So we're servants of Krishna. So this idea is that we begin our devotional service. It becomes more active in the... These are advanced levels of pure devotional service, actually. So this dasya rasa, this is a mood of being the servant of the Lord. And then it progresses also from there to... which rasa?
Friendship.
Friendship, yes. Or sakya rasa. And that friendship is one... How would we describe friendship with Krishna?
Like Arjuna and Krishna, they were friends.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
They're friendly relationship.
Yes. Any other friends of Krishna you can think of?
Cowherd boys.
The cowherd boys, yes. So many cowherd boys. Some as equal friends, some as slightly superior friends, some as slightly inferior friends, but different degrees of friendship, actually, with Krishna, making actually Krishna one's friend, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The intimacy of friendship becomes very strong. And then when the friendship is there, then there is some degree of familiarity also. And so the sense of awe and reverence is displaced by the intimacy of friendship. Like that. And then there is also beyond the friendship stage, there is the
parental love,
yes, which is called Vatsalya Rasa, yes. So this parental love is exhibited by some nice examples of devotees in a parental relationship with Krishna.
Nanda Yashoda.
Mother Yashoda, yes. And?
Devaki and Vasudeva.
Sorry, did you say Nanda and Yashoda?
Yeah,
Nanda Maharaj and Yashoda, yes. They're in a parental relationship. Queen Kunti, she's also in a parental relationship. She's Krishna's maternal aunt, so she's...
How about demons like Putana?
Yeah, they're not really in a parental relationship in their demoniac relationship with Krishna. Because that's not, in that demon relationship, that's not considered a loving dealing with Krishna. Because this is an unfavorable dealing with Krishna. So pure devotional service to Krishna is service offered to him, rendered favorably. But in that relationship, this is unfavorable because their intention is to kill Krishna. But certainly afterwards, Putana was elevated to the devotional platform because of a slight appreciation of Krishna in a motherly way when she offered her breastly nipple for Krishna to drink her milk. When Krishna killed her, he elevated her to the role of a nursing milkmaid in Vrajadam. So certainly she was no longer a demon, but actually... She was accepted as the Lord's devotee at that stage, but not beforehand.
And how about Krishna's friend Sudama?
Oh, yes.
Friendship?
Oh, yeah.
Relationship?
Yes. Sudama, Sridama, and Madhumangal, and so many others, Raktak, and different cowherd boys in Vrindavan. They all have so many hundreds and thousands.
They knew that he was a Supreme Personality of Godhead at the time, or...
At some point they became aware of it. But even before they became aware of Krishna's divinity, they just loved Krishna. And the cowherd men also, they loved Krishna. They expressed to Nanda Maharaj that, we don't know what it is about your boy Krishna. You know, we think that he must be some great demigod or something, or even the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There's something very special about him. And even though we want to forget him, we can't do that. You know, we don't know what's the situation with Krishna. We want to forget about him, but we just can't stop thinking about him all the time. Because their advanced love of Krishna is so pure and intense, actually. That's their relationship. They're devotees of Krishna, so they automatically think about him. But their relationship is very advanced. It's on the platform of spontaneous love that they offer to Krishna. It's not on the platform of Vaidhi Bhakti, which we follow, which is following the regular, or try to follow even the regulative principles of devotional service, the sadhana bhakti, like that. So their devotional service is very high level. It's performed out of spontaneous love of Krishna. So therefore it's a little different like that. And then beyond the parental love of Krishna, there is another level, the topmost level, which is known as conjugal love or madhurya rasa, which is experienced either as wedded love with the queens of Dwarka and unwedded love with the damsels of Braj. But in either case, the devotees are in love with Krishna, and Krishna reciprocates in all the relationships. And if the devotees want to serve Krishna as a lover, Krishna responds by being the supreme lover. And in this way, the supreme beloved Krishna reciprocates transcendental loving dealings with his devotees. So we've been reading an analysis, and if we have a look at page 389, actually no, not 389, 395, this is where we were up to. We could actually just read this, this second paragraph, Nanda Maharaj. Would you like Rohit Prabhu to read this chapter for us, this one on page 395, the one beginning with Nanda Maharaj told his wife, please, Prabhu?
Nanda Maharaj told his wife, "My dear Yasoda, although your son Krishna is my delicate and soft as the Mallika flower, he has gone to kill the Kesi demon, who is as strong as a mountain. Therefore, I have become a little disturbed. But never mind, all auspiciousness to my son, I shall raise this hand, which is as strong as a pillar, and I shall kill the Kesi demon, just to give freedom from all anxieties to the inhabitants of Raja Mandala." In this statement, there are two kinds of mellows, chivalry and dread. Both of them, however, improve the position of parental love, and therefore there is no incompatibility.
Thank you. So the idea is here, we were discussing something on this last week, that Nanda Maharaj, of course, he's in a parental relationship with Krishna, and his mood is, the mood of parental love is not that he's simply an equal with Krishna, but in a parental relationship, the devotee feels that Krishna is dependent on them, actually. So here we see that Nanda Maharaj's parental mood is that he's thinking that he's going to have to protect Krishna from the Keshi Dima. This is his thinking. And in that thinking, natural out of parental affection, he's thinking himself very strong, just like you see that a mother or father, they can take any strong role to protect their child out of great love, is it not? They become very strong, that how dare you attack my child. Even if someone insults or offends or hurts their child, they become strong like thunder. Even though they may be mild, placid people, if someone attacks your child, you become furious like fire, or like the thunderbolt. So this is a very natural reaction. So Nanda Maharaj, he is, after all, an elderly gentleman. And but still, he's thinking, out of his parental love, how to protect Krishna from the Keshi demon. And we see that therefore he's saying, "I shall raise this hand which is as strong as a pillar, and I shall kill the Keshi demon, just to give freedom from all anxieties to the inhabitants of Brajamandala." So of course Nanda Maharaj, he's the king of Vrindavan, so his duty is to protect his subjects also. And Krishna of course is his son, so certainly he must give protection to him too. And so this, in the first part, he's describing to Yashoda, his wonderful wife, that Krishna, he is so beautiful. He's as delicate and soft as the Mallika flower. So he's describing with great love how wonderful Krishna is, how beautiful and how extraordinary is his transcendental body. And he says, but despite that, he's gone to kill the Keshi demon, who's as strong as a mountain. So there's a great contradiction of moods here. On one hand, he's appreciating the sublime transcendental beauty of Krishna. And on the other hand, he's seeing that this wonderful, delicate, soft young boy has gone to fight and kill the Keshi demon who's as strong as a mountain. So it seems very incompatible at first glance. But here, he's saying, this has made me a little disturbed. But never mind. All auspiciousness to my son. If this is what he wants to do, then that's fine. I shall just protect him. So there are two kinds of moods. One mood is a mood of chivalry, of being very strong and challenging the Keshi demon, like that. So there's a chivalrous mood in thinking he will attack the Keshi demon and fight with him and show him and finish him. But on the other hand, there is parental love. But it's described here that these are not incompatible in this circumstance. Because in this circumstance, they're enhancing Nanda Maharaj's love for Lord Krishna, for Krishna. In this way, his love is increasing, either out of appreciation of his wonderful qualities, describing them to his good wife, or on the other hand, describing how he's going to protect Krishna and kill the demon. Either way, the intensity of his parental affection is being enhanced. So this is the thing. So, as we shall see in these verses and in the last two chapters here, that actually it's all about increasing the affection for Krishna. Now you may say, well, if somebody's on the platform of pure love of God, then they've already achieved perfection of life. But the nature of the perfection of life, sorry, it's just that way, we don't see the wire. Otherwise I look at you and I think, poor Nityananda and the others, they've got these wires hanging in front of them.
They're not hanging on there.
Anyway, the idea is that what we shall see is that, as we've been experiencing, devotional love for Krishna is always increasing. It's never static. It's not that that's it, now we've achieved perfection and where do we go from here? No, because the nature of the spiritual sky and devotional dealings with Krishna is that both for Krishna and the devotees, the pleasure is always increasing. If you've done something once in the material world, then it gets a bit boring after a while. You know, we've done that, we've been there, we've been so many times to see the relatives on a Sunday afternoon. You know, we've watched this same Bollywood movie so many times. And the pleasure becomes decreased. But in Krishna's pastimes, actually they're ever fresh. The pleasure is always increasing. Instead of being static, they're dynamic. They're ever expanding in their transcendental blissful nature. And therefore, even though Krishna may do the same or a similar pastime again and again, it's always fresh, like the first time that these are done, actually. So this is the nature of these transcendental affairs. Any questions or comments so far? Okay, Jayananda Prabhu, would you like to read us the next paragraph then, please?
In the Lalita Madhava of Sri Rupa Goswami, it is stated, after Krishna's arrival in Kamsa's arena, Kamsa's priest looked at Krishna with a distasteful expression. The entire arena was filled with dread on the part of Kamsa and his priest and restless expressions of pleasure on the cheeks of Krishna's friends. Frustration was felt by his envious rivals. The great sannyas meditated. Hot tears were in the eyes of Devaki and other motherly ladies, and hair stood on the bodies of the expert warriors. This was astonishment in the hearts of demigods such as Indra. The servants danced, and the restless eyes of all young girls danced, glanced about, In this statement, there is a description of combination of different mellows, but there is no incompatibility.
Mm. This is very nice. Everyone know what we're referring to here? What incident is being referred to at this point in time?
Just before the fight with the elephant Kavalya and Krishna Maitri, they didn't know that King Kamsa, you know, to fight Kamsa, eventually to kill Kamsa as well.
Yeah, they've actually come to Kamsa's wrestling arena.
Right.
Kavalyapida had been killed, and this is Krishna's arrival in Kamsa's arena, so this is just before the wrestling match, actually, when Krishna and Balaram were fighting with Chanura and Mushtik, respectively. And then Bal and Shal and Toshal and the other wrestlers, they all got killed also by Krishna. So the very nice description in the Srimad Bhagavatam about how everybody was seeing Krishna according to their different relationship with him. And here we see that Kamsa's priest looked at Krishna with a detestful expression. So Kamsa had a very much dread. He had great dread of Krishna because he was always thinking, when is Krishna going to come and kill me? And Kamsa's priest, he was thinking, this is a ghastly situation. He's really detestful looks at Krishna. This is his way of looking at Krishna. And then we see that the entire arena was filled with dread on the part of Kamsa and his priest. So Kamsa and his priest have got great dread of Krishna. And at the same time, Haribol Parag Prabhu. And here we see, on the other hand, that restless expressions of pleasure are there on the cheeks of Krishna's friends. So the cowherd boys, they've got a completely different relationship with Krishna. They're experiencing something completely different relationship with Krishna. And then we see also that frustration was felt by his envious rivals. So this is another experience of a relationship with Krishna in such frustration, because they're envious of Krishna. So they wanted to be the ones who were going to kill Krishna. And here they're thinking that Krishna is now going to be killed. And also, the great sages, they're absorbed in meditation on Krishna. So when Krishna is there, ready for this big fight in the wrestling arena, the great sages, they're simply meditating on Krishna. So just see how all these different relationships are going on simultaneously. And in Devaki and the other motherly ladies, there was hot tears in their eyes. They were so much in anxiety about Krishna, out of motherly affection for Krishna. So these hot tears were coming from their eyes. They were very angry with Kamsa, because Kamsa was putting Krishna in a very difficult position, they considered. So there were hot tears of anger with Kamsa, and out of great affection and compassion for Krishna. So also we see that the expert warriors, they saw Krishna and Balaram, and the hairs of their bodies were standing on end, just at the incredible vision of seeing Krishna and seeing what was about to happen, that this was a very unfair fight between these young boys, these great powerful heroes, but still Hare Krishna, still yet young boys, and these great powerful wrestlers, Chanura and Mushtik, who Kamsa had engaged, Hare Krishna, especially because Kamsa wanted to have Krishna killed. So these very nice things. And then yet we see other expressions of love for Krishna. There was astonishment in the hearts of demigods such as Indra. They were experiencing astonishment that how is it that Krishna and Balaram, these two young boys, are getting ready to fight with these huge, powerful wrestlers, the most powerful wrestlers anywhere. They've been brought in, especially by Kamsa. Kamsa had these alliances with all these demons, and he was in this way going to consolidate his position as the king of all the tract of land, known as Bharatvarsh. In this way, he had this big plan to conquer the whole universe. So there was some serious astonishment. And what do we see? The servants were dancing. They're thinking, this is such a nice thing, that here is Krishna. He's so beautiful. They know Krishna's power. Krishna's potency. And so they're dancing in ecstasy to see Lord Krishna. And here we see also, what about the young girls? Well, their restless eyes were simply glancing about here and there. This is the nature of young girls. So, in this way, I hope you're not going to shoot that.
Nope.
Okay.
Not yet.
Okay.
Should I close the curtains under it?
What are you going to do?
Put
the
phone on the ground.
Alright,
yeah, you
can do it,
yeah.
Close
it.
It's okay.
Yeah.
No,
you can.
You don't have to close it if you don't want. It's okay. So anyway, but the idea is that normally when there's a mixture of different relationships, it may be an unpleasant mixture. But here, the mixture of all the different relationships is very pleasing, because everyone's got their different relationships with Krishna, and Krishna is the supreme victorious person. So it's actually quite tastefully done. So this expression, normally in poetic dealings or in dealings describing Hare Krishna Prabhuji. Are you, Prabhuji, please don't eat at the same time as touching Krishna's things, because the mouth, the body becomes contaminated. So you should please finish eating and wash the mouth and hands, Prabhu. Thank you. So the idea being that all these different loving dealings, they are very significant. Whereas in the writings of the Acharyas, they don't make any untasteful or distasteful expression of these mixtures of mellows. And it's an important scientific fact that in a devotional literature or devotional poetry or songs, it shouldn't be an incompatible mixture. So this is one of the scientific points from the advanced science of devotional service. So then we see, any questions or comments about this so far? Is it okay? Okay. So, Ashok Prabhu, would you like to read this next statement, please? This last paragraph.
A similar statement, which is free from incompatibility, is in the Lalita Bhagavad, wherein the author blesses all the readers of the book in the following manner. Although the Supreme Personality of Godhead is able to lift a mountain with the finger of his left hand, he is always humble and meek. He is always very kind to his loving devotees. He has frustrated Indra's attempt at
vengeance
by refusing him the sacrifice of Indrayagna. He is the cause of all pleasures to all young girls. May he be ever compassionate for you all.
So this is a blessing by Srila Rupa Goswami from his book The Lalita Madhava, where he's actually hoping that we'll all become blessed by these wonderful varieties of loving dealings with Krishna. So, yes. Because he's describing that although he's able, as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, to lift a mountain with the little finger of his left hand, and the fact is that he's always humble and meek in spite of his great prowess, and that he's always very kind to his loving devotees. And another wonderful aspect of Krishna is that he's frustrated Indra's attempt at vengeance by refusing him the sacrifice of Indra Yagna. So this is Krishna's supreme position. So therefore, and not only that, but he's the cause of all pleasure to all the young girls. So he's requesting the Lord, this great Vaishnava, Srila Rupa Goswami, on whose book this Nectar of Devotion is based, on Srila Rupa Goswami's book, his blessings are there, that may be he ever compassionate upon all of us for reading these transcendental literatures. Because just by hearing about Krishna, actually we invoke Krishna's blessings. Once we agree to hear about the glories of Krishna, once we agree to start chanting Krishna's glories, and especially one may think, okay, just chanting Hare Krishna, even knowingly or unknowingly, this has great benefit. But as one starts to become conscious of Krishna's exalted position, and when one chants with attention, knowing that this is the name of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and starting to focus very nicely on Krishna, then the relationship becomes gradually sweeter as we learn to gradually approach Krishna more and more with some beginnings of devotion to our chanting. When we're actually starting to chant and hear about Krishna, because this is very pleasing to Krishna, actually. So, actually for us, it's very natural that we gradually become attracted to hearing about Krishna. And that, because we're acting also on the platform that Krishna is the all-attractive person, but we're acting a lot of the time because this is what gives pleasure to us. But the loving platform of devotional service is to do something because it gives pleasure to Krishna, actually. So as that devotional love develops, then everything progresses in devotional life. When we're chanting Krishna's name in such a way as to please Him, we're calling out Krishna's name with great love. Just supposing, I gave this example in Manchester one time, that just supposing your partner in life was singing your holy name to their heart's content and singing your name with such love and affection that you just became captivated by hearing how much love and affection there is in their voices when they're singing your holy name. How would you feel? And as Gaura Krishna put it, he said they'd have to do it quite a lot before I was convinced. But the fact of the matter is that yes, we also have to do it quite a lot before Krishna becomes convinced that we really mean it, that actually we love Krishna. And we have to do it to develop and awaken our love for Krishna. So this is a very interesting transcendental fact. So any other question or comment? Okay, so let's move on to chapter 51. This is the last paragraph, this is the last chapter. Apart from, we'll find there are some concluding words and some words also in the appendix about Srila Prabhupada, just briefly. But it's a very short chapter, yes. It's actually about 2 pages when you add it up. So let's read on. So, Rohit Prabhu, would you like to read the first, the title and the first couple of paragraphs for us, please? Chapter 51.
Rasa Vasa.
Okay, if you can give us the chapter of the title also.
Sorry. Perverted expressions of manners. Rasa Vasa, or incompatible mixtures of manners, may be classified as uparasa, false expressions, anurasa, imitation, and aparasa, perverted or misrepresented manners.
Okay, so we're going to hear a lot more about this in these 2 pages. So here we're discussing rasa-basa, or the incompatible mixture of loving dealings. So now 3 divisions. One is a false representation, which is called uparasa. This is a false expression, and we're going to get into this discussion. And second thing is anurasa, which is an imitation rasa. Like that. So there's a false expression, there's an imitation of a rasa, and aparasa, which is a perverted or misrepresented mala. So these are ones which are generally taken as not proper. They're unconstitutional. They're not proper expressions of dealings in devotional service. But yet we're going to hear more about this with a surprise twist in the tale. So, let's see. Please carry on then, Rohit Prabhu.
There is the following statement by the impersonalist who had just seen Krishna. When a person has passed completely from all contaminations of material existence, he realizes... He relishes a transcendental bliss of being established in trance. But As soon as I saw you, the original personality of Godhead, I experienced the same bliss. This perverted the reflections of mellows is called Santa Uparasa, or a perverted reflections of mixed impersonalism or
and
personalism.
Okay, I think we should try and explain some things here. okay, so generally the impersonalists, they are on the threshold of devotional service because they may not yet have started developing appreciation of the personality of Godhead. They may be appreciating only Krishna's impersonal feature. And in that way, it's nice that they're appreciating an aspect of Krishna. So that is also good, that people should appreciate Krishna's impersonal feature. It's just like saying God is great. It's something, but it's not very much. Actually, when we start to understand about who Krishna is and what Krishna is, and his qualities, his forms, his names, his pastimes, his entourage, his devotees, then we start seeing the glorious variety of who Krishna is, and we start to develop more devotional understanding of Krishna. Because actually one can be devoted to a person, but to be devoted to an impersonal substance is not actually devotion. The idea is that being attracted to Krishna, the person, then there is the possibility of a loving exchange. But for example, you can't, although you may appreciate the wonderful design of this book stand, you may see that it's been created in a very wonderful way, you may see that the wood has got beautiful grain and texture, but you can't have a relationship with it. You may appreciate it as being very nice and very special and an incredible work of art and so many things. But actually, when you start to appreciate and develop a relationship with the person who made that thing, then actually you can have a rasa, some relationship, some exchange with that person, when you realize the qualities of the person behind it and start to approach them. So similarly, the impersonal Brahman, this is very much a subordinate feature of Krishna. It's simply his bodily rays. So, you know, you can't go and hug the impersonal Brahman. You know? But you may be able to fall at the feet of Krishna. And as the case of the four Kumaras, who were at one point fixed in the impersonal conception of Krishna, of the Lord. But when they smelt the flavor, the aroma of the tulsi leaves mixed with saffron that were decorating and adorning the lotus feet of Krishna, then their minds changed. Then they became attracted to the personal feature of Krishna and started to wanting to render devotional service. They wanted to exchange loving service with Krishna. They wanted to offer loving service to Krishna. And Krishna reciprocates with the way we approach him. So this threshold of devotional service is called Shantarasa, or neutrality, or a passive adoration of Krishna. But when it becomes active in devotional service, it becomes developed actually into devotional service. So here, in this point, there is someone who is an impersonalist. Right? And he'd just seen Krishna. So he's thinking in this mood of impersonalism that actually the same bliss that he's getting from the impersonal Brahman that he's now getting just by seeing Krishna. And actually, but the bliss he's getting because of his impersonal relationship is very insignificant compared to the loving mood of devotional service. That sort of transcendental bliss is on a very high level. And that would never be considered the same for those who are on the platform of loving service to Krishna. We see in the earlier part of this book many descriptions about how the impersonal realization of Krishna is something that the devotees wouldn't trade, not just for all the tea in China, but actually they wouldn't trade, they wouldn't accept these different kinds of liberation. They would consider them to be like hell, because they wouldn't get the chance to serve Krishna. So that impersonal appreciation of Krishna is a beginning, but it certainly is totally insignificant as far as the devotees are concerned. They have no wish. They consider it a hellish thing, because if you become absorbed in the impersonal effulgence of Krishna, the Brahma Jyoti, the Brahman energy of Krishna, then you lose your individuality. So how will you serve Krishna? What is the possibility of rendering loving service to Krishna if you've amalgamated your personality and individuality into the Brahman? So in this way, this very unadvanced impersonalist, he's thinking here that just by seeing Krishna, that he's getting the same bliss as by merging into the impersonal Brahman. Actually, it's a start. It's a start, but it's not a very good mixture, because the devotees know that the impersonal Brahman blissful experience, so-called blissful experience, is nothing in comparison to the bliss of rendering loving devotional service to Krishna. So this is why it's described as this perverted reflection of mellows is called Shanta Uparasa. This Uparasa is a false expression, because it's simply not really very true. It's not the same bliss at all. So this is why Shanta, as in Shantaras, Uparasa, it's a, what is that? A false expression being expressed by these impersons. And therefore, this particular expression by the impersonalist is considered a perverted reflection of mixed impersonalism and personalism. Yeah? Does that make some sense? Just bear with us, and we'll try to understand. Okay, Ajahnanda Prabhu.
I just one question. You know, it's always said that once you mix with this Brahman effulgent, you know, then you only stay there for temporarily. You know, you can't stay there for permanently. Then you again fall back on the planet Earth. You know.
Yes.
Because there is no activity on the Brahman platform. You know. But then, so if you merge yourself in Brahman platform, you know, effulgent Lord Brahma, then how do you regain your individuality again? You know.
Well, if in this life one has situated oneself in the liberated platform of being absorbed in Brahman, but still he's living within this material body. So there's a kind of dual identity going on. And in spiritual life, we see also there is a dual identity, because there are the external activities, but also there's the internal development of one's spiritual advancement. Just as we see that there are devotees on different levels of devotional service. And sometimes their activities are very bewildering, because we don't understand what platform of devotional service is inspiring them to act in a different particular way. So, for example, you may see that a very advanced devotee comes before the deity and may become completely struck with wonder, or may start shivering, or may just start dancing in the air in great ecstasy and ecstatic love. That is not generally displayed by a pure devotee, because they don't do anything which would draw attention to themselves as a general rule, but they may be unable to help that actually happening. Not to be confused with the sahajiyas, those who take everything very cheaply, and who do these things to draw attention to themselves, and just see, I'm an advanced devotee, like this, and start dancing and laughing and rolling on the ground as if they're experiencing real ecstasy, and yet at the same time being absorbed in mundane consciousness about having sex life and smoking bidis in the material world. So there's no question of them actually being on the advanced devotional platform, because there's no incongruity between the external activities and the internal activities, but simply means that one cannot always understand what level they're on. Now, this point about the devotee being coming out of the impersonal Brahman, yes, it's just like if you go on an aeroplane journey, everyone here has been flying through the air, I take guess. And but there is a point how long you can stay up in the air. You have to come back down to land. Because that's the natural environment. There must be some activity. How long can you stay there sitting in your seat just flying through the sky? There must be some shelter. Even the astronauts going from, they must come back to land on some planet or another. Yes? So the principle is that one can be absorbed in the impersonal nature of the Lord, but after a time one will need some activity again. And because in the impersonal Brahman one doesn't have the purified intelligence and purified activity, then again there will be material activity. Why? Because the desire is there, and therefore the facility will be given to come back again and have another material body and have another stab at material enjoyment. So this principle, we should know, is actually going on. So the nature of the question was that how can these two things be existing simultaneously, yes?
Yeah, once you merge with the impersonal Brahman, you lose that individuality, you know?
Yes, just like you may appear to lose your individuality, just like if you are wearing a green bird suit and you fly into and you climb into a green tree, you may think, okay, now I'm indistinguishable from the green tree. Or a green bird flies, we experience this in Vrindavan and the banks of Kusum Sarovara. There was one very nice green tree, and there was a green parrot flew into the tree. And it was very difficult to make out what had happened to this green parrot. It appeared to have merged with the tree. So the same principle. But actually when he flew out again, you could understand, well, he didn't actually merge with the tree, but he just appeared to. So similarly, the living entities, they appear to merge with the impersonal Brahman. But their individuality isn't factually extinguished. Just it appears like that. But because of their avishuddha buddha, because of their impure intelligence, then they again take birth in the material world. Why do we take birth now? Why are we going to take another body next time? Why have we taken this body? Because we had different desires. And therefore material nature awards us a material body according to our desires. And similarly the living entity in the impersonal Brahman. Still he hasn't purified his intelligence. Still he's got material desires. And when he has the, even though he may have come to the liberated platform, it's something which doesn't last. Patantiyada. Again he falls down, avishuddha buddhayo patantiyada. Because of impure intelligence, he again falls back down to having another material body in the material world. And the practical example is so many Mayavadi and impersonalist sannyasis, they come from this country, from India, and they travel all over the world, and what are they doing? They're supposed to be on the advanced platform of spiritual life, but they're engaged in mundane activities. In collecting money for schools and hospitals and other mundane institutions. Why? What happened to their bliss of Brahman? Why have they now again come back down to the material platform of mundane activities? It means that those activities ultimately are not satisfying. Otherwise, why come back down from the liberated, advanced, staunch platform of being absorbed totally in transcendental consciousness, why they've now come back down into material consciousness. They've given up the activities of working for the material body, and now again, they're back engaged in philanthropic and welfare activities, working for the welfare of material bodies. So this is the point, that these activities of the impersonal Brahman are actually not satisfying to the soul. As can be very easily evidenced by this. Otherwise, why are these advanced sannyasis again coming back down to perform material activities? If they're actually getting the bliss out of those spiritual activities, then they don't come back down to material activities. They don't come back down to the material platform again. So this needs to be understood. Is anyone out there? Or have we logged out?
I think, yeah, from saving up, but on Skype. No, there's no one there.
Okay. All right.
I think we lost the internet connection.
There was somebody there, you?
So, any other question on that? Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Is it clear? Is it clear enough? Okay. So, would you like to read us another paragraph, please, Jan and Nicole?
There is another statement as follows. Wherever I am glancing, I simply see your personality. Therefore, I know that you are uncontaminated Brahman effulgence, the supreme cause of all causes. I think that there is nothing but you in this cosmic manifestation. This is another example of uparas, or the perverted reflection of impersonalism and personalism.
Okay, so let's try and see this, because this, just to make it very clear in this example, that this impersonalism means to be absorbed in thought of the Brahman effulgence of Krishna as everything. But here, there's a mixture. There's a mixture of impersonalism, of being thoughtful of Krishna's Brahman effulgence, and there's a mixture of personalism, knowing that you are the supreme cause of all causes, and I think that there's nothing but you in this cosmic manifestation. So Krishna is explaining in Bhagavad Gita, Brahmanohi Pratishtaham. He says, I am the basis of the impersonal Brahman. This we should know from Bhagavad Gita. And he says that I know that you are the uncontaminated Brahman effulgence. Just like the sun is producing unlimited quantities of effulgence, sunlight effulgence. That sunlight is not contaminated, it's pure, it's coming, but then it becomes filtered through the glass and through the coloured medium which it may come through to us. So this mixed devotee is saying, wherever I'm glancing, I simply see your personality. So this devotee has got a kind of schizophrenic attitude. He's actually absorbed in impersonalism, but at the same time, he's gradually getting the idea of Krishna's personality, that actually everywhere there's Krishna's person, beginning to understand that actually not only there is the Brahman effulgence, but every atom, Krishna is present in the atom. And everywhere the devotee looks, actually he starts to remember Krishna. Here's a nice seat. What about Krishna sitting on the seat? What about offering a nice seat to Krishna? Or, for example, looking at the ground. I mean, you take any example and you think, can I find Krishna's footprints there? Marked with a flag and conch shell and thunderbolt and trident. Anything you see, someone who's on the platform of love of Krishna will see everything in relationship with Krishna. There won't be anything that he sees separate from Krishna. He sees everything. He sees Krishna everywhere, actually. This is an extraordinary state of consciousness. So this impersonalist is becoming Krishna conscious, but at the same time he's still got this idea very strongly fixed in his consciousness of the impersonal effulgence, which is so absorbing. Because Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, klesho dikararastesha, those who are fixed on this path of impersonal understanding, he says for them advancement is very troublesome. Therefore, better not to go down that road. We should understand it, but our aim is not to go down the road of trying to become absorbed in the impersonal feature of Krishna. Better directly try to become clear about Krishna's personality. Yes? Is it true? This is Krishna's statement in Bhagavad Gita. So, anyway, but the devotee, this personality is saying, I think that there is nothing but you in this cosmic manifestation, which is a fact, because in Bhagavatam, Krishna explains that before this material world, before the spiritual world, before the universe and all these planets existed, there was only I, Narayan. There was nothing else. And while the universe is going on, it's all my energy, it's still only me. And at the end, when everything is wound up, there will still be only me. So the devotee gradually starts to understand about Krishna by hearing Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, that actually everything is Krishna. And yet, although it is Krishna, it is different from Krishna. Just as the sun and the sun's rays, you can't really separate them, but they're different. So similarly, the jivas, we are also, this material world is Krishna's energy, but it's not separate from Krishna, because it's manifested by Krishna, it's maintained by Krishna, and ultimately becomes absorbed back into Krishna. And the living entities, the jivas, are eternal particles of Krishna, Krishna's marginal energy. They also exist, but as eternally existing individuals, not temporarily manifested and wound up like the inferior material nature. The jivas are eternal, but they are also parts of Krishna. Just like this, the Lord Chaitanya explains this principle, that the infinite supreme being is there, completely perfect, but he becomes even more perfect when he's surrounded by an infinite number of infinitesimal parts and parcels. Is that okay? So this is Krishna. Everything, but it's his energy. All expansions of his energy. Therefore, there's only Krishna. Okay. So anyway, this explained here that this is another example of uparas, or a perverted reflection of impersonalism and personalism, because he hasn't really got on the platform of pure devotional service yet. So it's a mixed mood of an impersonal appreciation of Krishna and a personal appreciation of Krishna. Therefore, it's not quite so tasteful. Yes? Okay. Michelle, would you read us a paragraph, please?
When Madhu Mangala, an intimate friend of Krishna, was dancing before Krishna in a joking manner, no one was paying attention to him. And he jokingly said, "My dear Lord, please be merciful upon me. I'm praying for your mercy." This is an example of uparasa, in fraternal affection and neutrality.
Ah. So this comes on to quite a different level. So here we're seeing that here's Madhu Mangal, he's a very intimate friend of Krishna. And here are some very nice joking dealings, because actually he's a very wonderful, very funny Brahmin friend of Krishna. And no one's paying attention to him, so he's saying something really slightly offbeat just to try and capture people's attention. Yeah. He's saying that actually he's now coming from the platform of friendship into the platform of shantarasa, like that. Neutrality, because in the mode of neutrality, one is simply praying for the mercy of the Supreme Lord, like that. This is in the mood of passive adoration of Krishna. But actually, a friend isn't on that mood of awe and reverence. A friend is on the mood of more intimate dealings. But someone who is on the platform of Shantarasa, or devotion and in awe and reverence, they're on that platform of asking and praying for the mercy. So in this way, there's a nice joking here of Madhu Mangal, that he's mixing it. But at the same time, it's an example of uparasa, because it's a perverted reflection. It's a mixture of fraternal affection, or friendliness, and neutrality. So, is that okay? So that's a different type of mixture, but still it doesn't quite sound right, that here's Madhu Mangal's friend praying for Krishna's mercy. Yes? Okay. Is that right? Okay, so Rohit Prabhu, would you read us another paragraph, please?
Comes Kamsa once addressed his sister, Devaki, as follows. My dear sister, having seen your dear son Krishna, I think that he is so strong that he can kill even wrestlers as strong as the mountains. So I will have no more anxieties about him, even if he is engaged in a terrible fight. This is an instant of Uparasa in a perverted reflection of parental love.
This is just before the wrestling match. So here we see that we're again talking about Uparasa, this first one of the three, false expression, because he's speaking in a false way to Devaki, because he's thinking, oh, that, you know, he's expressing in one sense, oh, that I'm not going to be anxious about Krishna getting caught up in the fight. Actually, his thinking is he wants the wrestlers to kill Krishna, but he's presenting it in a false way to Devaki, Krishna's mother, and comes his own sister, that I won't have any anxieties for him because I've seen him, that he's so powerful, that he can destroy. He can kill even wrestlers as strong as the mountains. So this is, therefore it's Uparasa, it's a false expression. Like that. So in other words, the language that is used covers a multitude of different meanings, actually, as we're seeing from these. We're seeing the Uparasa in the sense of mixed impersonalism and personalism. We're seeing the Uparasa as a false expression in terms of friendship and dasya and what is that? And Shantarasa. And here we're seeing a false expression by Kamsa, a false expression of parental love towards Krishna. But it's that actually, it's a false expression of parental love, because he doesn't have parental love for Krishna. He just wants to kill Krishna. So this is very much a false expression. So it's being used, this Uparasa statement is being used to describe a variety and multitude of different conditions. Is that okay? Okay. Any questions or comments? If you have any question, please do feel free to ask. Yeah. Okay. So, Rohit Prabhu, I think is it your turn again? It's your turn. Your turn, sorry. I lost track.
In the Lalit Madhava, Sri Rupa Goswami says, the wives of the Yagnika Brahmanas were all young girls and they were attracted to Krishna in the same way as the gopis of Vrindavan. Out of their attraction, they distributed food to Krishna. Here the two devotional mellows are conjugal love and parental love, and the result is called Uparasa in conjugal love.
So here's a rather different expression again of Uparasa, because we're talking about the Yagyika Brahmins, the Brahmins who were very much absorbed in sacrificial mode. They wanted to offer great sacrifices in order to be elevated with their fruitive activities to the heavenly planets, to a higher condition of happiness in the material world. Therefore, they're called Yagyika Brahmins. They're interested only in sacrifices. They weren't interested in loving dealings to Krishna. So they're actually like parents, parental love, coming to feed Krishna, actually. So it's a very interesting conception here. You can take it in different ways. But although out of parental love you may take it that they're coming because Krishna and Balaram are hungry, and the cowherd boys have told them that you should, you know, please give some food to Krishna. When the yogic Brahmins were asked for food on behalf of Krishna and Balaram, because the cowherd boys, they'd approached Krishna and said, look, we're really hungry and we really want something to eat. Krishna, you're so good at killing demons, but can you please kill off our hunger? Because we're so hungry. Just can't you hear our tummy's rumbling? You know. So first Krishna sent them to go and beg some charity in Balaram's name from the yogic Brahmins. But the yogic Brahmins, they wouldn't even speak to them. Because they considered, oh, you're just cowherd boys. We're big Brahmins. We're doing our sacrifices. You leave us alone. Yeah, we're not talking to you. This puffed up attitude, actually. They couldn't appreciate that the cowherd boys were telling them, well, actually, now's a really good time in your sacrifice because it won't be against the rules of yajna, because it's reached that particular point in your yajna where now's a good time, where you can distribute the food. It won't be prohibited. And they were giving very good instruction. They were actually dictating to the Brahmins that you should act like this. But these Brahmins, they couldn't appreciate the dictation of these cowherd boys, that actually they were quite competent to dictate to the Brahmins because they were friends of Krishna. They were on the platform of advanced devotional love for Krishna. So they were quite in a fit position, actually, to tell the Brahmins what could be done and what could not be done. And they were very factual in their explanation of it. So, anyway, they wouldn't talk to the cowherd boys. They wouldn't even answer them when they asked them for some food. They couldn't appreciate their exalted position. So they came back to Krishna very disappointed and still very hungry. And so Krishna said, all right, well, this time you go to the wives of the Brahmins, because actually they're all my great devotees. And if you ask them for something to eat, they will certainly give you something and there will be no difficulty. So they went back and when the Brahmins' wives, you see, they're a different community. The gopis, they're all the cowherd girls, the village girls. But here, these are not Vaishyas, these Vaishya girls, these are Brahmin girls. They're the wives of the Brahmins. Yeah. So they're actually on a different material platform. But it's considered that practically there's some parental love, how to feed Krishna and Balaram and look after them. Just like parents, if they see the children are hungry, immediately they, out of parental affection, they'll cook something up. Have you ever had that experience? You've come to your mother's house and your mother has asked you, oh, can I get you something to eat? You experience like that? When mother cooks for you, then, oh, it's very nice. I think we've all had that experience, even when we grow older. So, up to a point at least. But the principle is that actually these young girls, they were attracted to Krishna in their own internal consciousness. Actually, they were attracted to Krishna just like the gopis of Vrindavan were. So here, there are two devotional mellows. Out of their attraction, they distributed food for Krishna. So there are two mellows. One is conjugal love and parental love. And so this uparasa, although they're coming apparently as the wives of the Brahmins, actually they're attracted. It's a false expression, because actually they're attracted in conjugal love to Krishna. Is that okay? Does it make sense? Okay. Any other question or comment? So let's read one more paragraph. Is it your turn now, Ashok? Is that right? Yeah. Okay.
One of the friends of Srimati Radharani told her, my dear friend, Ganda Ravika Radharani, you are the most chaste girl in our village. But now you have divided yourself and are partially chaste and partially unchaste. It is all due to Cupid's influence upon you after you saw Krishna and heard the sound of his flute. This is another example of uparasa caused by divided interest in conjugal love.
Mm-hmm. So this is Radharani's position. She's being described, Hare Krishna, as the most chaste girl in the village of Vrindavan. And in a number of ways, this is a false representation. Because on one hand, they're saying that actually this is the influence of Cupid upon you. But Krishna is known as, there is Kamadev or Cupid. But there, Krishna, in one of the Gayatri mantras, he is addressed as Kamadevaya, which means he is the transcendental Cupid. Because Cupid, he shoots his arrows in the form of taste, touch, smell, sound and sight and invokes lusty desires in the hearts of the living beings. But Krishna, by his transcendental arrows, one becomes attracted to Krishna. This is not mundane Cupid acting. This Krishna is known as the transcendental Cupid. Because when one sees, when the sight is there of the beautiful form of Krishna, or one hears the sound of Krishna Katha or Krishna's name, or one tastes the sweet, delightful flavor of Krishna Prasadam, or touches something wonderful connected with Krishna, or so in all these different ways, or smells the wonderful fragrance of incense or flowers offered to, or the prasad which is offered to the Lord. All these actually have a transcendental impetus. They don't waken up mundane lusty desires. If they do, then there's something very wrong. It means one's consciousness is on seriously the material platform. But in fact, they awaken transcendental attraction for Krishna. So this is the transcendental Cupid. So in this sense, it may be taken as a false expression. That's in one sense. But in another point, it's also taken here, as we'll see in the next paragraph. But he's saying, she's saying, Radharani's friend, one of her friends is saying, "My dear Gandharvika, Radharani, you were the most chaste girl in our village, but now you've divided yourself and are partially chaste and partially unchaste." So actually, Radharani is always chaste because she's never touched. Even Abhimanyu, her supposed husband, can never actually touch Radharani. This is a very extraordinary situation, but it is a fact. Radharani is only ever touched by Krishna. So, otherwise no male can touch Srimati Radharani. And so, actually she is always fully chaste. But it appears, for the sake of pastime, that she's become unchaste. Because the just like the example is given, that out of the two types of Madhurya, loving relationship with Krishna, there is wedded love and there is unwedded love. But of the two, the unwedded love is considered more advanced because it's more exciting, actually. So Krishna experiences that great adventure in the unwedded loving dealings between himself and the gopis. It's a very wonderful transcendental relationship. In Dwarka, the queens, they're on a very wonderful platform of being the maidservants of Krishna. But actually there's a real sense of adventure and excitement and double dealings in the whole nature of Krishna's loving dealings with the damsels of Braj. So it appears to be a statement that Radharani is now unchaste. She's only half chaste, but actually she's always chaste. She's only loving Krishna. But for the sake of enhancing the transcendental pastimes between the devotees and Krishna, these loving dealings are actually going on in Vrindavan. And I think that's about as much as I can say on this topic. Is that all right? Okay, so let's leave this for now. We'll come back to this on page 398 next Thursday and discuss some more and see how far we get. Is that all right? Okay. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Sri Nectar Devotion ki jai. Nithai Gaur Premanandi Hari Bol. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pastaya Bhutaraya Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swamini Tanamani Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pachari Devasesha Sanyavari Pastya Jare Shatam. So far we've been reading these examples, extraordinary examples about Upara.